writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Kim, what words did you write this week?
Absolutely nothing.
What happened?
It's not a matter of not having inspiration, but just having so many other things that have to get done. And I'm just not finding a block of time to sit down and say, now I will write.
You are a parent. You have children.
Yes. I have kids. I have house projects. I have the podcast. I just have not been able to get back into an organized schedule. And I suspect part of it's because I have no idea where the world is going to be in a week, like whether or not the kids are going to be at home from schooling. It's very hard to organize your time if you fundamentally believe that everything's going to be shooken up in a couple of days' time, you know?
Right. It's also hard to be creative in uncertainty. Your brain is trying to focus on protecting its time or its daily, whatever. You know, there's a lot of unknowns going on. When that happens to me, I have a hard time being creative.
Is that happening to you now?
That is happening to me now, actually. My mom is not doing so hot. She's got lung disease, not COVID, but she's got lung disease and starting to take its toll. They're moving her to a long-term care place. That's going to take a lot of driving now. But I did start a class, so I am taking a writing class that started yesterday with a teacher that I'm familiar with, and she's very encouraging. So, you know, I have something due in 2 weeks. So no matter how uncertain my life is, I got to get something done.
So next time we talk, you will have something that you can have shown that you've written.
Yeah, for better or for worse. And no recycling, because when you get enough work done, you know, over the years, you've got this big pile and the pull to recycle in a workshop that has not read your stuff before. It's pretty strong, especially when you want to be lazy. I'm committed to writing something new, no matter how uncertain my life is.
In today's episode, we cover chapter 6 of John Gardner's book, The Art of Fiction. He promises technique, but spoiler, we don't think he delivers, except maybe on why writing exercises are a good idea. We do get into some great discussions on vocabulary, the sentence, point of view, style, and delay. Last being the focus of today's writing exercise.
So technique.
Yeah, the previous chapter, Common Errors, like it was very direct. And even if I didn't necessarily agree with the advice, I will say that it was all very solid writing advice.
Right.
This chapter, however.
Dude, I feel like he lied to us. Like I was excited. I was like, I'm going to get something out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And he just dashed my hopes and dreams.
Darn Gardner.
I know. Like he says, you know, the very beginning, what the young writer needs to develop to achieve his goal of becoming a great artist is not a set of aesthetic laws, but artistic mastery. And I'm like, ooh, okay, cool. We're gonna start getting into the nitty gritty here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more you read, it's just, he pulls you into a false sense of security. What did you think of this chapter overall?
Overall, it was like being at a party where everybody's talking about stuff you don't know and that you thought you should know. And even the stuff you thought you knew, you didn't know. And you just stop talking because you realize you have nothing to contribute. And then you even kind of pull away because you realize you'll get nothing out of the conversations.
Yeah.
I mean, he lists so many authors who I've either only heard of or haven't heard of, and pieces that like I'm reading the description, I'm thinking, I don't understand what this work is or why it'd be important.
I mean, he's mentioned most of them before, but it seems as if maybe he's pulling from his modernist lecture class. Maybe he was assigned a class on modernism and he has to teach it every year, right? So he's probably pulling from that because he talks a lot about like Bartholomew and that one. Bartleby is like, that's a staple of modernist short fiction. Everyone has to read it in your modernist lit class. And I'm like, he just teaches this. He is recycling, but he's not using it in a very effective way for a young writer. Every once in a while, I read this stuff and I'm reminded of the title, Advice to Young Writers.
So at the very beginning, he actually has two important lessons. This little bit here was the one part that I thought was pretty good. He talks about one of the advantages of doing exercises is that the writer's relative indifference to his material can be an advantage, meaning that because you're not writing about your mother or about this story you've had in your head for forever,
you don't have any emotional stakes, you know, and also you're like, this must be published.
Yes, it has a deadline, so you know it has to get done and you're just going to push yourself through. And sometimes like with exercise or sports, you know, sometimes you just have to keep pushing yourself through to get to the end and your body learns stuff. Maybe your brain learns stuff by just having to write all the way to the end of the exercise and turn it in.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, he even mentions that sweet spot, writing an exercise, the writer is in the ideal artistic state, both serious and not serious. He wants the exercise to be wonderful so that his classmates will applaud, but he is not in the dark psychological set of the ambitious young novelist struggling to write down his existence as it is with the ghost of the young James Joyce standing horribly at his back. This is like that sweet spot where you've not invested your heart and soul into this idea of a novel you're writing because it's an exercise. You're just doing it to get people to give you feedback. Hey, I did a good job. Glad you like this.
When you're laying your heart out for a piece, when it's like everything that you want to be, and maybe you could get it published, become famous. I think there's just a whole bunch of pressure you put on yourself.
Right. Totally. It's great to do these activities. And we both agree, small, short activities, maybe on character or description are great. But then he moves on to what you do with them when you are writing the novel. He calls them structural units. He says the second important lesson the beginning writer learns is that fiction is made of structural units. It is not one great rush. Every story is built of a number of such units, a passage of description, a passage of dialogue, an action, another passage of description, more dialogue, and so forth. The good writer treats each unit individually, developing them one by one. Do you do that when you write a story?
I've always thought sentences should do more than one thing. Like each sentence should not only advance the plot, but maybe also give some insight into the character, or a line of dialogue should have an interplay between the two people, but also be laying the groundwork for something else. But maybe when you're first writing it, it's good to be able to break it down in that format. It is really hard to try to write everything all at once.
Right. It's interesting though, because I don't think of when I'm writing my book, I don't think of structural units. Maybe that's my problem. I write like what happened in my life. And then I kind of take it and I write it. And of course, it's not great. Then I go through again and I just keep reading it over and over again until I kind of structure it a little bit better. And I guess I'm always thinking of what is my reader going to need? What are they going to want? What am I trying to get across? And trying to mediate between those three things.
I think you're making structural units that way because you're saying, what does the reader need here? So it has to be something here.
Right.
When I'm writing news stories or features, because everything has to support ideas and the ideas have to flow. It's like, okay, we need to explain to the audience what DNA is, or we need to introduce who this person is and why they are important to the article. So my background is trained in discrete units, but it sounds like you're doing that. And part of it's because you've spent so much time reading. You're used to like, here's a paragraph of description. Here's some dialogue. Here's an action sequence.
Right.
So I think that it's good advice to realize that stories are broken down in parts. Sometimes just having someone phrase something a particular way can be the light bulb that goes on in people's brains. Mm-hmm. So useful. And then we get to the next section.
Right. Which are not what I expected as a reader. I thought he was going to go into maybe some exercises, things you can do while you're writing. You know, this is how you would set up a description to do this or this, or here's a trick with character.
Or here's an example from a piece. Let's take it apart and see what's there.
Right. How did I marry these two structural units together to create something?
Yeah, this section didn't even have a Helen of Troy. It just bounces all over the place.
This was painful to read. So essentially, he just goes straight into this thing about truth. And if you're confused, listener, we were too. He says, in contemporary fiction, technique is on the whole more self-conscious than ever before. Telling the truth in fiction can mean one of three things. And those things are bizarre.
This section is really muddled. It's a whole bunch of hand waving, and I kind of just started skipping around.
Right. This was just a very hard, and it was long too. It was like 5 or 6 pages of weird stuff about truth and style. It was just, I don't even know.
Basically, you can pick up from page 128 and hop all the way over to page 142, which I think we should do right now with the let us turn to specifics, at which I wrote, yes, dear Lord, yes. But again, it's a little bit of a bait and switch here. He had several of them, and I think we should go through each of them, starting with imitations.
Yes. Through human experience is universal in many ways. Attitudes change from age to age, and one way of coming to understand our ideas and emotions is to study them through the spectacles of some earlier form or set of aesthetic premises. In the same way, the writer may copy some old idea, the dream vision, the imaginary voyage, the Saint's legend, or the framed narrative, and may translate the form to suit modern experience. Essentially, you take something old like a fairy tale or a myth, and then you just make it more modern. For example, Taming of the Shrew becomes 10 Things I Hate About You.
Right. Or the other option is you basically mimic some other piece to figure out how it works. Because sometimes you can only really get into it if you're actually writing down the words.
You're soaking up that prose and that style, and your brain is mirroring and encoding the cadence of how it's written.
It's basically go find older stuff that you like and just try imitating it, either by taking the story and applying it to a modern setting or just working through what's written there on the page.
Have you ever done this?
Sometimes I like to just take a passage and write it several times through just to see if I can figure out what's going on in the sentences or what's going on in the paragraph. Actually, I think it's a pretty useful technique.
When I was younger, before I had a computer, I used to have a little journal and I would read things and I'd like them and I'd want that poem and I'd want to keep it, but the book comes from the library. So I write the poem down in my little book so I could keep the poem and read it whenever I wanted. Doing that, I had to rewrite the poem. You know, it kind of helps you adopt their sensibility a little bit. That is a good technique. So he did give us a good technique.
Uh-huh. So then we move on to vocabulary.
Yeah.
What do you have to say about Gardner's vocabulary?
I don't know if he's aware of the fact that he argues against his own prose style, but he does. As he says, a huge vocabulary is not always an advantage. Simple language, for some kinds of fiction at least, can be more effective than complex language, which can lead to stiltedness or suggest dishonesty or faulty education.
I think he's basically saying if you use vocabulary poorly, if you just pick a couple of favorite big words and use them, it's not going to work. You can't just use the thesaurus to pull out big words and add them to your stories. You need to have a deeper knowledge. And he has for advice for his young writer. He has here are two things. Either you should read the dictionary or you should learn a language, preferably a dead language like Latin, you know, as to build your vocabulary.
Do you think Gardner knew Latin?
I'm pretty sure he did.
No.
This is Gardner. Can you imagine in high school saying, okay, kids, you can learn German or French or Latin. And he's like, I'm going to learn Latin because that nobody uses that language.
I guess so.
That would totally be him. He is right. I mean, if you learn Latin, if you learn Greek, you will have an understanding of our language that's a much deeper level.
True. I really don't think it's necessary though.
How about reading the dictionary?
You know, I would never just sit there and start reading the dictionary to improve vocabulary. I would just read. But I will say there is one strategy I use out of the dictionary as a poet, and I've used this and it's worked every time. Sometimes I'm writing and I need the word. There's a word I need. I don't even know what that word is, but it's like I'm writing and I just like there's this, I need something and I can't think of it. So I open a dictionary and I will just randomly start looking at words. And every time I do that, within a page or two, I will find the perfect word. And sometimes it's a word I know, but most times it's not a word I know. But I read the definition and I hear it in my head and I'm just like, oh. And one story about this is a poem I wrote. I found a title through looking at the dictionary and it was called Omnicide. I'd never heard of omnicide. I'm like, what is omnicide? I just opened it and there it was. And it's a species that kills itself or like commit suicide, like an entire species. And I was like, this is a perfect title for my poem.
Like the urban myth about lemmings.
Yeah. Or humans eventually when, you know, we kill ourselves off with global warming and other things. So anyway, that word would never have been on my radar had I not looked in the dictionary. And now it is. Now I know what it is. That's a great word. Moving on to the sentence.
That was quite the section. So first of all, what I disliked was that he wanted to give an example of a sentence that went on and on. Because this is Gardner, he had to pick a character's troubled mental process, some intelligent middle-aged housewife, for example, who has read about women's liberation in her magazines and feels an incredibly anxious inclination hedged by doubt. And on the other hand, to take night school courses, one in flower arrangement or ceramics or self-awareness. That is so Gardner. Oh my God. It's like every time he decides to include a woman, he almost wish he didn't.
Would you go so far as to say he's a misogynist? I don't know if he hates women, but he's certainly a jerk.
Anyway, and then he goes into the whole fancy rhythm stuff on sentences. You've actually learned how to do this, right, Renee?
What he does here is he includes sentences and then he has all these dashes above the words to show their rhythm. And that technique is called scansion. And I learned it in my British canon class. They give you a poem and then you have to figure out all the beats of the line. It helps you identify the type of poem. Different styles use different beats. So this is what he does. He goes, well, you want to pay attention to your sentences and you can figure out the rhythm of your sentences and that'll make you a better writer. And he goes through and he does all this scansion. He's even got his own marginalia, which he's made up. He is showing off. I mean, this, I guess, could be helpful for some very high-minded writers. But man, something like this would turn off a young writer. They would read this and they would see this and they'd be like, oh my God. So really, I think this technique is dumb. I wouldn't do this. This would cripple a young writer or even a seasoned writer trying to do this. It'd be a waste of time.
And on to the next section, point of view.
So what'd you think of this section?
I caught the idea that he had a hierarchy of points of view and the idea was you started at first person narration and you worked your way up until you finally got to essayist omniscient. And that was like the be all and end all.
Oh God.
So he starts off with the first person narration.
Using I.
It is often said, mainly by non-writers, that the first person point of view is the most natural. This is doubtful.
I don't know. I mean,
I think some truly great works have been done in the first person.
Lots and lots and lots.
I have a friend that's been writing a novel in first person, and the issue she runs into is it is difficult to describe settings or what other people are doing when you're writing from first person. There's definitely some limitations you butt your head against.
It's very intimate. You have to really know your character.
Right. But also, like, if you walk into a room and the person narrating the story doesn't notice something, but it comes into play later on, you have to figure out some way for them to notice it, but not remark on it too heavily. Your tunnel vision, you end up with a lot of like somebody relaying a story to them of something that's happened or some sort of weird setup why they would describe a room that they walked into.
I could see it being difficult. I could definitely see it being difficult. Then he moves on to the third person subjective.
A point of view in which all the I's are changed to he's or she's, with emphasis placed on the character's thoughts. So that then she saw the jug becomes, was that a jug she saw?
That's not doing the third person subjective fairly.
Yeah.
That's rude.
Yeah.
There's a better way to write that anyway.
I was kind of told third person subjective was also described as third person close, where you don't have to have the tags she thought. You can like jump right into their mind for a little bit and then pull back again.
Right, right. Your narrative distance gets shorter and shorter and shorter and then get longer and can kind of contract back and forth. I don't think that's bad. Actually, I kind of like third person subjective.
But he did not. He said, even when the fiction is benevolent, the third person subjective point of view can achieve little grandeur. And then, you know, to go even further, it thrives on intimacy and something like gossip. It peeks through a keyhole, never walks through an open field. An even less grand point of view is third person objective.
Identical to third person subjective, except that the narrator not only never comments himself, but also refrains from entering any character's mind.
The result is an ice-cold camera eyes recording, which if you think about it, when you're watching a film, the actor is showing you everything that's going on in their mind.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it?
Anyway, he doesn't like that. Then he goes to ethereal omniscient point of view, which is a god's eye view and jump in anybody's head. What he says is even more superior, the SAS omniscient view, where you're not necessarily God, but you're some kind of amalgamation of some narrator that can get into people's head. The interesting thing I find is that I have a critique group that I sometimes work with. And when I pull out somebody that's written in omniscient form, people actually have a hard time with that.
Well, yeah, I see. Actually, it is difficult. In the 18th century novel, 19th century, that was a very popular way of doing it. You are God. You know what's going on in everybody's heads. Mm-hmm. If not wielded right, it gets confusing. Like, well, who's the protagonist? Why do we have this distance away from these characters? How can we dip into everybody's heads like that? A lot of contemporary writers, they fix that issue by making it more of a third person where each chapter is maybe dedicated to one character. Mm-hmm. It is a little jarring because it feels old, but it doesn't mean it's bad. Why does it bother your critique group?
I think that Gardner's reaction to why he doesn't like close third person, but likes the omniscient is the same ways in why people feel the other way now. You get used to a particular style and you don't see the limitations of that style.
Right.
I notice he doesn't spend any time on second person at all.
Well, there was that one book.
It wasn't Bright Lights, Big City, was it?
Yes. Bright Lights, Big City by Jane McInerney. People have called it a gimmick. In my creative writing classes in college, they didn't say don't do it, but they were like, well, it's kind of a gimmick.
Anyway, he doesn't include second person. And then we get to the section called delay. Can I say that this section had absolutely nothing useful in it whatsoever?
You can say that. And if you do, you would be correct.
At least in the other sections, I came up with what they might tell you to do. But like the delay is, okay, you need to make the paragraph before the climax be something that people want to read, even as they're trying to get to the climax.
Right.
Which obviously every paragraph you write, you want people to actually read and not skip over.
It was like, how do you deal with tension? I guess, right before the tension goes off, right before the gun goes off, mm-hmm. I make the reader interested. Well, the gun's about to go off.
A good portion of his section on how to keep the readers engaged is about waiting for Godot, which I think was all about not ever getting to what was supposed to
be. Right, nothing happens. Yeah, just kind of builds and builds and builds and then...
Yeah, anyway, I did not find this to be a terrible useful section.
Now let's flip through it.
And then we get to style.
Yeah.
About style, the less said, the better. Nothing leads to fraudulence more swiftly than the conscious pursuit of stylistic uniqueness. But on the other hand, nothing is more natural to the young and ambitious writer than that he try to find a voice and territory of his own, proving himself different from all the writers. My take on this section, he just kind of throws up his hand and says, you do you.
Right. Yeah. It's just, this is your voice. This is what you do, which is weird. A lot of books do focus on voice and developing voice. And a lot of my teachers put a lot of emphasis on that is something you really need to be working on. You should always be developing your voice. It was actually a really important aspect. But given that he spent like 8 pages on truth, he doesn't hardly even spend a page on style.
I suppose his defense is you should be developing a style, but it's your own style. And I can't tell you about how to develop that style. He did say that there are some writers that choose to just work within a certain pattern that they already know and then trust that their own experiences and the plot that they're talking about will make it uniquely theirs. And then others will try to experiment in different styles of writing and they'll just develop them. I got the feeling that he didn't feel like you could actually teach anything about style other than to give them a push and say, go off and do it.
Maybe that was the fairest thing he could do. One of the best pieces of advice he gave was to not give advice.
I think when people talk about the usefulness of the second section of the book, they skim over this chapter.
Yeah. So anyway.
So for our example, since Gardner didn't actually tell us anything about how to do delays.
Thanks for nothing.
He did include it in his exercises. And so given that he didn't tell us how to do it, only that it was important to do it, perhaps we shall figure it out by writing it out ourselves. So on page 202, exercise 1 says, write a paragraph that would appear in a piece of fiction just before the discovery of a body. You might perhaps describe the character's approach to the body he will find, or the location, or both. The purpose of this exercise is to develop the technique of at once attracting the reader towards the paragraph to follow, making him want to skip ahead, holding him on this paragraph by virtue of its interest. Without the ability to write such foreplay paragraphs, one can never achieve real suspense. So We are each going to write a paragraph of right before the discovery of a body.
That actually seems like a good activity.
Can I say that I enjoyed this exercise more than the Purple Prose exercise?
You can. I agree. This one was actually fun.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to talk about this one. And I think our listeners will too.
So I'll read mine aloud. It's pretty short. It's just a paragraph. It's a very long paragraph, but it's just a paragraph. 9:42 already. The old bat was going to have a cow. Maxine put her phone in silent mode and lay it screen down on the passenger seat of her Jeep. So when great Aunt Genevieve called to chastise her for being late, she would have some deniability. On second thought, Maxine tossed it into the back seat. You wouldn't expect me to reach for it while I was driving, she rehearsed in her head as she stepped on the gas. That wouldn't be safe, Auntie. Maxine just caught the yellow light and drove through on red. The pedestrian at the crosswalk flipped her off. She returned his gesture with a benevolent smile, the same one she'd be using when Aunt Genevieve griped about having to wait to take her shower, not having milk for her tea, and how Maxine's mother should have raised her scatterbrained daughter. Well, boo on Auntie for never having ungrateful kids of her own, or being so stingy with her bank accounts full of money to pay for grocery delivery or an in-home attendant. The milk Maxine had purchased thumped against the door as she took the turn at speed. So long as she made it there before 10, she slow rolled through the next stop sign before pushing the accelerator 5, 6, 7 miles above the speed limit. As she zoomed by, she thought she heard brakes squeal and an angry honk, but no buzzing from her phone. There was Auntie Street. There was Auntie's driveway. Maxine grabbed the milk, left the phone, bounded up the stairs. The front door was open. No need to use her key. In she went. Aunt Genevieve, I'm... And that's where it ended. I was considering a line that would say, Maxine wasn't the only one who was late, like being late, dead. But since we're supposed to stop it before the discovery of the body, I figured that was telling too much.
Right. Usually, I'm not like a fan of when dialogue ends suddenly like that. But this one worked out. It's good because you would stop mid-sentence if you stumbled upon a body. Off the bat, I want to know what she found. Like, I want to know if Aunt Genevieve was murdered. Like, she bounded up the stairs. So is she like drowned in a bathtub? Is there blood? Did she just fall? Did she
fall down the stairs, or was there actually a knife in her back? Yeah.
Right. So you got me there. But that's because I know that there's going to be a body. Anyway, just threw that out there real quick. Then we'll move on. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I really love the voice in this piece. I just got to say that first line is hilarious. The old bat was going to have a cow. That was great. It was like, okay, this revealed right away the voice of the character. We got the voice of Maxine. We get that she's annoyed. And also, I already kind of adopt her feelings about Aunt Genevieve. I'm like, yeah, old bat. That was all expertly done. Like, that first line was good.
Yeah, that one just, well, those lines just pops into your head. And it's kind of ridiculous in a certain way. You'd never think of mixing the two together. But once you got a bat and a cow, it just...
Once you got a bat and a cow. Yeah. I'm like already getting in the snark, you know, I'm like getting in there with Maxine. So yeah, I was kind of just wondering, what was your process for writing this?
Well, the two requirements for the paragraph was that we had to know what was coming up. Finding the body was not to come out of nowhere. The paragraph is having all these hints that something is coming up, in this case, at the apartment where Maxine is going to, you know, that you'd want to just jump and see what she finds at the apartment, right?
Right.
So it had to be all laid out, all the details that would, in this case, set up for a murder thing. We got the rich old aunt that nobody likes and has no direct descendant. So there's all those clues. It's like, oh, something's going to happen to great Aunt Genevieve. But then I needed to have something that would keep the reader's interest in finding out more about Maxine as a person and also the various steps Maxine's taking. So I decided that rather than have the slow burn, or in the book, Gardner describes a scene of a person coming to open a door and having that dread just before she opens the door, not wanting to open the door because of various things that the audience is cueing in on, and that slowed down feeling. And I thought, instead of doing that, how about if I throw a whole bunch of stuff happening to Maxine as she drives? So our anticipation is on her getting to the apartment, but our attention is spent on whether or not she's going to get in an accident on her way there because she's so distracted and she's doing this irresponsibly. So I want to keep the reader grounded reading the paragraph because they wanted to find out if Maxine would get in an accident or something would happen to her on the way because so many things were happening right before she got there.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't anticipate her getting into an accident, actually. That wasn't what was in my head. I got the feeling that Maxine just drives like this all the time.
Well, that would also possibly get into an accident. Yes.
It could. But I didn't see that. What kept me reading, one was the voice. That really kept me going. I wanted to hang out with her. You know, she seemed like a fun person to hang out with. She's just one of those snarky friends that is just fun to be around. I've had a few of those. I might be one of those. I'm not sure. To somebody else.
I totally didn't base this character on you in any way, Renee.
Not at all. I never had any old relatives I had to take care of. Okay, listener, I did. And if you read my memoir, you'll know all about it. But no, this one, I actually wasn't thinking that she was going to get into an accident. And that wasn't necessarily why I was reading. One, it was the voice. So I was intrigued by what she cared about. She cared about not having to tolerate Aunt Genevieve. But also, I just wanted to know the history. I really wanted to know why she bothered. Did she think she was going to get the money? And if that was the case, then I kind of wanted that to be revealed. But if that was revealed, I don't know if she would be much of a friend anymore. I don't know if I'd want to hang out with Maxine. For me, I didn't keep reading because I thought they were going to get into an accident. I kept reading because I wanted to understand and know Maxine's motives for actually helping Aunt Genevieve.
That was a problem I noticed with the way this exercise was designed, because the exercise wants you to write the paragraph before this big, huge event that will propel the story onward. But because we're just starting with that paragraph, we're also having to introduce everybody and their mode. And they were having introduced a lot of stuff into that paragraph because the reader is starting afresh.
Oh, yeah. I actually thought I was doing it wrong because I'm like, well, I'm establishing a character and a plot here. Like, I'm doing a lot in this paragraph.
Right. Because that's what you need to do to build. The reason why we picked this exercise is because it does illustrate the delay concept he uses in his techniques. And there's a phrase in here, the woman getting to the door. She stopped to listen, eyebrows lifted. And if the movie is a good one, the sound that has troubled her is one we've heard before, though she perhaps has not. So he's envisioning this point where a whole bunch of backstory has already been there. If I were to rewrite this, it might be useful to have a summation paragraph that goes before. This is Maxine, and she's doing this and this, and this is what we know about her before, and this is the immediate events that have happened, and now we're going to jump into that paragraph.
Yeah.
And in that case, I could have concentrated almost exclusively on her driving and things that were running into her, and possibly her retorts that she would want to give Aunt Genevieve, but maybe not so much about the fact that Genevieve isn't willing to spend money on a grocery delivery service, or things that maybe would have already been given ahead of time, so I wouldn't have to drop them in.
Right. If this is to be self-contained and to be read in like a workshop group, there has to be something in there. This activity does lend itself to writing a really long paragraph.
Yes. Although I think a long paragraph makes sense too. The goal is to make the reader hang on. If we made it a short paragraph, it wouldn't be any work on the reader's part. So to make the writer really work for it, they have to write a long paragraph that if they do it poorly, the reader will want to skip over.
Right. Like Gardner says, when the writing is successful, the reader senses that the climax is coming and feels a strong urge to skip to it directly, but cannot quite tear himself from the paragraph he's on. Mm-hmm. So when you were writing this, were you thinking of what makes a reader want to jump ahead?
I wanted to give the anticipation of wanting to see what Aunt Genevieve was going to say, of wanting to see that confrontation. You know there's going to be something big happening when Maxine gets to that house.
Right. By virtue of lingering on the whole journey of her getting the milk and then driving all the way.
Well, that's what my intention was. I think what actually happened was, like you said, the personalities were such that you wanted to see the two in the same room together.
Something that would be more traditional would be Maxine going through the house looking for Aunt Genevieve.
Right.
She walks in, she doesn't see her. Like, that's the thing I was wondering is the expectations that she had. Maxine is kind of expecting the phone to vibrate, so she throws it in the back of the car. But then there may have been an opportunity when the phone didn't vibrate. Mm-hmm. And Maxine didn't think about that. Maybe there would have been a ping, like, huh, that's weird. The phone should be buzzing by now. Or she was surprised
right.
in some way. Like, something was wrong. So far, nothing was wrong. The only thing that would have tipped me off that something was going to happen was that the door was open.
Yeah.
But that wasn't until the very end.
Yeah. The phone didn't ring. And I didn't emphasize that because I was trying to keep the paragraph fairly fast paced. One of the things Gardner warns about is using the anticipation or the unsettledness of the main character as to transmit that feeling to the audience.
He warns us about it?
Yeah. He says, the two easy solutions to this problem are common. One is the author's first or third person entry into the suspense-filled thoughts of the character in the hope that the character's suspense will rub off on the reader. And having the character go through the house and getting more and more concerned is transmitting the character's thoughts to the readers as to elevate the intensity.
That's true. He does specifically say, don't do that. Is that because it's cliche or is that because it feels disingenuous?
I would say with Gardner, he'd say it was disingenuous. And also because best-selling writers get away with it.
Right. So if Gardner is warning us against that, what are the techniques that we're supposed to be using to keep a reader wanting to jump ahead, but not jumping ahead?
I think Gardner distinguishes between just saying that the main character is anxious or concerned or feels like something is wrong versus putting the reader in the situation with the main character to feel anxious or feel that something is wrong. Mm-hmm. So if you just simply had a character wandering through the house, just concerned that something was wrong, but without giving the actual play-by-play, the in media res, I think is the term, then you're just telling the audience, oh, my character's really worried about this. You should be really worried too.
Makes me want to read the detective book right now or a mystery, because those writers, mystery writers, they must be masters at building up this tension, but not doing it in such a way that it feels like you're being led.
Actually, Gardner says we even agree that we're going to be led, but we have to enjoy it along the way.
Right.
It's like the horror movie. I mean, you know, the killer is going to jump out of somewhere, but part of what makes you watch it is because you don't necessarily know which twists or turns your heroine's going to take. The novelness is the path they take and all the incidental things that come at you, not the overall structure that they're wandering through a house with the serial killer coming after them.
Right. It's like a slot machine. It's the novelty.
Right.
The not knowing exactly what the outcome is, even though there's only so many outcomes there could be. So it's the unpredictable yet predictable combination of details that gets revealed in a surprising way.
Right. So that's what keeps you reading because you're not sure which details are going to come back. And the unsettled feeling has to come not because your heroine is saying she feels that way or because you're describing the heroine as feeling that way, but because we in the situation start to feel that. When I was writing this story, I really wanted to give you the feel of Maxine driving in her car over the speed limit and pushing things so that you were there with that anticipation she had as opposed to just telling the reader that she was driving too fast.
So in that case, I almost kind of wonder if we should be anticipating something else. What is forcing her to drive fast? It's got to be worth it. Mm-hmm. It's either a form or an example of Aunt Genevieve chastising her in a specific way that is motivating her to drive fast. And so I would want an example of her doing it. And then I go, oh yeah, fuck that. I wouldn't want to, I'd drive fast too.
These exercises are kind of meant also to be in the moment. We're not going into a full psychological profile of what this Maxine character that's been helping to take care of this ungrateful great aunt of hers and all the elements that go into her life. That would be the actual story. If this was a story, the scene wouldn't have happened in isolation. There would be other stuff about Maxine and about Maxine's life.
That's true. So I'm asking for more than the activity can deliver. Would Gardner think that this was a successful paragraph? Did we do what we were supposed to be doing? Would he have been happy if we were in his class?
Yeah, I think this was a successful paragraph. My end goal in writing this was to keep the reader reading, but to build anticipation that something big was coming in the next paragraph. And like you said, I thought I was doing it through the driving account, but apparently it was much more through the voice that was being carried through, but it worked. And you had a slightly different take on this, which we will be discussing in our Patreon account. We have set up a Patreon account, Words to Write by Podcast. There are links on our webpage. This allows people to contribute money to us every month to help us pay for hosting services and the work we put into the website and the podcast. For $2 a month, you get to be at the Abby tier.
Abby.
That's Renee's cat. For people that subscribe, they'll hear us discuss Renee's paragraph that happens before she discovers the body.
But also you'll get written copies of these things. Because sometimes, you know, hearing is good, but reading is better. You can analyze our activities and stuff like that.
And Renee's been pretty busy. She's writing a summary version of the various chapters of Gardner's book. So if you've been listening to us and you want to go back and say, well, what did Gardner say about the 10 common errors? Renee's going to have that on the Patreon site.
So right now I'm in the throes of writing these chapter notes. They're kind of long, actually, and pretty in-depth. So, you know, if you end up on there, please give me some feedback. Like, let me know, was that helpful? I put lots of key quotes in there and our interpretations of them. And I try to keep them pretty well organized. But man, feedback would be great. Yeah.
We are really looking to boost our visibility on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. So if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, could you rate the show? Because we only have 2 ratings right now. I'd love it to go up to like, you know, 5 or 10.
Yeah.
Or could you give a review? We'd really appreciate that.
Yeah, they go a long way, listener. So, you know, a review would be really, really helpful for us. Every little bit helps.
And I think that's it for today's podcast. Next week, we are on the final chapter of Gardner's book.
Da-da-da. I'm excited. We're almost done. You're lucky, listener. You didn't have to read this book.
Oh, now. So tell us the final chapter, Renee.
So the final chapter in John Gardner's book, The Art of Fiction, is plotting. You know, this one's exciting because there's charts in it and stuff.
There's like the triangle plot, and then there's one with like little squiggly lines on it. So it'll be a fun time.
Yeah.
So tune in on the next podcast, which will be coming out when we get it done because this stuff's taking longer than we thought. Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening.
Thanks, everybody. This has been fun.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Don't say repetitive chronology when you can just say history repeats itself.